Many systems manifest radically different behaviors, dominant behaviors at different length and time scales. And we might take as our paradigm case here a steel girder. At the scale of meters, we're interested in its bending properties, its buckling strengths, etc. At the scale of nanometers or smaller, we care about lattice properties, various bonding strengths, etc. In order to design materials like steel girders, one has to attempt to deal with phenomena across 10 plus orders of magnitude in spatial scales. So there's my little picture. What's important is that what we see up here near the in the scale of meters to maybe millimeters or smaller is a kind of scaling uniformity there. But as you zoom down, you see all sorts of different structures that appear at different levels. So in this report, a blue ribbon report from the NSF on engineering-based science, simulation-based engineering science, they say that virtually all simulation methods known at the beginning of the 21st century, which I believe is still now, were valid only for limited ranges of spatial and temporal scales. Those conventional methods, however, cannot cope with the physical phenomena operating across length scales 12 orders of magnitude in time, such as protein folding, or 10 orders of magnitude in spatial scales, such as the design of advanced materials. At those ranges, the power of the tyranny of scales renders virtually useless all conventional methods. That's where my title comes from. Confounding matters further, the principle of physics governing events often changes with scale, so that the models themselves must change in structure as the ramifications of events pass from one scale to another. The tyranny of scales dominates simulation efforts, not just at the atomic or molecular levels, but wherever large disparities in spatial and temporal scales are encountered. So macroscopic scale behavior often falls also into large common classes. So consider the class of isotropic elastic solids, for example. Typically, those classes are characterized by a small number of phenomenological parameters, a pair of elastic moduli, such as Young's modulus and the shear modulus. These parameters characterize systems exhibiting the same, that is, and I want to use this term in its sort of technical sense, universal behaviors. Here's a not so clear picture, but up here we have basically the steels are grouped together in this plot of Young's modulus versus the density. Down there you got various wood things, etc. Sorry that didn't come out better. So the question that I'm interested in is how can we model. This is a graph which basically exhibits universality classes. So the class of steels, like steel girders, would be in this region characterized by a certain range of values for Young's modulus, right? I think hopefully it'll become clear as I go on. All right, that is to say, these various different kinds of steels, various kinds of alloys of steel exhibit similar sorts of behaviors that at the macroscopic level are characterized by a small number of parameters, the elastic moduli in this case, right? That's what I'm interested in trying to understand eventually. Hang on just a second. Hopefully it will become clear. So the question is that I'm interested in is how we can model and understand systems that exist across this extremely wide range of scales. Applied mathematicians employ continuum models, and it looks like they have to. They also employ atomic or molecular models, and it looks like they have to. But many philosophers and physicists also hold on to some sort of reductionist picture about modeling strategies. Whatever the fundamental theory is at the smallest basic scale, it'll be sufficient to tell us about the behavior of the systems at all scales, or so they claim. So continuum modeling on that view represents an idealization, a smoothed out imitation of a really much more complicated microscopic world. And furthermore, the suggestion is that those continuum models are, in principle, eliminable. So continuum model equations, such as the Navier-Stokes equations and the equations for elastic solids, work despite the fact that they almost completely ignore the small-scale or atomistic details of the systems, the steel bars or the fluids. But as we'll see, the almost is very crucial here. The recipe by which continuum models are constructed, I'll call it Cauchy's recipe, is safe. If we follow it, we'll most always be led to empirically adequate equations which characterize the macroscopic behavior. Why is the question. Why is that a safe recipe? What sort of explanation can we give to understand that? Surely it has to have something to do with the physics that's modeled at the smaller scales, of the systems at the smaller scales. So the question is, will an answer to this puzzle about why continuum idealizations based on Cauchy's recipe are safe provide any solace to those who have these in principle reductionist predilections? So I intend to answer an outline to the puzzle, intend to outline an answer to the puzzle, and I also intend to show that those who believe continuum models are eliminable in principle are mistaken. You can, it can be, so that is to say, we should just go to the fundamental theory and everything can be done there, and we don't need to, we can just follow all the molecular or atomic interactions and get everything that we want. Recent philosophical literature has focused on reductive emergence relations between statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. One of the key components of this is the role of the thermodynamic limit, as Leo said, in connecting these theories and in providing an understanding of phase transitions and critical phenomena. Kadanoff says in his book, the existence of a phase transition requires an infinite system. No phase transitions occur in systems with finite numbers of degrees of freedom. Philosophers have been absurdly confused by this true and reasonably benign statement. They say, surely this can't be right. After all, tea kettles contain a finite number of molecules. Get rid of these continuum idealizations. So I want to consider the role of the thermodynamic limit in a more general context. And the context is just one of how we can connect or upscale from finite statistical micro theories to a continuum macro theories. And one prominent view that's largely driven by the philosophical confusion surrounding that claim, I think, is that the use of continuum limit is to be justified solely on purely pragmatic grounds. It's a matter of convenience. And as such, since it's a matter of convenience, we would have an account of continuum modeling that fits with a reductionist or a limitivist program. So Jeremy Butterfield puts forward a straightforward eliminativist justification of this kind. One's justified in using the infinite limits in modeling systems with finite degrees of freedom for two broadly instrumental reasons, mathematical convenience and empirical adequacy up to required accuracy. After all, we use continuum idealizations to abstract from finitary effects such as transience and edge and boundary effects. And secondly, the mathematics of the infinity, the calculus is more convenient than the mathematics of the large finite. Here's what he says. Consider a mass density of a fluid or a rod. For an atomistic model of the rod that postulates n atoms per unit volume, the average mass density might be written as a function of the position within the rod and the side length L of the volume, L cubed centered on X, over which the mass density is computed. Now the point is that for fixed n, this function is liable to be intractably sensitive to X and L, but we take these limits and we can define a continuous, maybe even differentiable mass density function as a function of position and enjoy all the convenience of the calculus. As Butterfield says, so much by way of showing in general terms how the use of an infinite limit n equals infinity can be justified but not mysterious. So that's the stupid cartoon picture I have. So that quote, I think, describes what we can call representative elementary volume averaging. It's a legitimate means for upscaling when identifies a macroscopic value of a function such as density of a material with the continuum limit of that representative elementary volume. And if all uses of limits fit that methodology, then I think Butterfield's straightforward justification for the use of continuum idealizations would be reasonable. Then we'd be able to justify a broadly reductionist approach to the relations between models and theories at largely separated scales. But so can the REV averaging explain the safety of Cauchy's recipe for constructing adequate continuum models? Models that invariably yield adequate equations for governing macro behaviors. So to answer that, I need to describe what I've been calling Cauchy's recipe for continua and Euler's recipe, what I call Euler's recipe for molecular and atomic modeling. So let's start with Euler. Newton's second law is insufficient by itself to tell us how some bodies is going to behave over time. It's a general dynamical principle, and it's independent of the kind of body under investigation. For discrete systems, point particles say we need an addition to specify the nature of the forces acting on the particles. Are the particles massive? Then we need to consider gravitational forces. Are they charged? Then we need to consider Coulomb's law. These special forces or constitutive laws are crucial to the modeling process. Once we have them, we proceed in the following way. Choose Cartesian coordinates along which we can decompose the special forces. Sum the forces acting on each particle along the appropriate axis. Set the sum for each equal to ma. That gives us our differential equation for which for a few particles or certain symmetries we can, it doesn't have to be Cartesian. Now Cauchy's recipe, for discrete particles, there exists a recipe for finding continuum, there exists a recipe for finding continuum equations. One starts with the continuum analog of F equals ma, which is the Cauchy momentum equation, and determines the constitutive equations as before. For a solid, is its stress linear related to its strain? That is, does it obey Hooke's law? For a fluid, is it viscous, compressible? What are the nature of the surface pressures? And scaling at macro and near macro scales plays a crucial role in the successful implementation of this recipe. Answers to those questions allow us to derive, that is about the constitutive equations, allow us to derive for elastic solids, the Navier-Cauchy equations, and for incompressible fluids, the Navier-Stokes equations. And the parameters all there come from the input of these constitutive or special force laws. Now, Cauchy's recipe is a key component of the applied mathematician's methodology, but now the problem that I mentioned at the beginning of scale separation comes into the fore. We know that fluids really aren't continua. What's the relationship between the molecular dynamical models that track individual molecular behavior at the scale of nanometers and equations like those of Navier and Stokes that act at the scale of millimeters? So here we have our puzzle again. Why does the Cauchy recipe work on the macro scale? Why is it safe to use it? The answers involve telling a story about how properly to connect a statistical atomic theory to a continuum theory, how to connect statistical mechanics to hydrodynamics. And that's, I think, the story of the renormalization group and related so-called homogenization strategies. So from the point of Cauchy's recipe, one derives the Navier-Stokes and Navier-Cauchy equations independently of any views whatsoever about the molecular atomic makeup of the medium. And in the 19th century, there were doubts about whether material was atomistic. In fact, there's this really interesting historical controversy that I don't have time to go into, which pits sort of Navier and Cauchy, who started with a bottom-up molecular sort of strategy, and Green and Stokes, who started with continuum strategies to try to determine the right number of elastic constants, the right number of moduli that one should have. And there was a big debate that raged throughout the 19th century about rara constancy versus multi-constancy theories. But I can talk about that later if you want. It's the equation that I'm using to describe the behavior of elastic moduli, of the elastic solids. Okay. The key physical fact is the bulk behavior, is that the bulk behavior of fluids is almost completely insensitive to the actual nature of the physics at the shorter distance. And the almost here is because the details that we don't know about the microscopic structures get encoded in a small number of phenomenological parameters that appear in the equation, namely the viscosity, the elastic moduli, et cetera. So based on work by Ken Wilson, especially in his paper, Critical Phenomena in 3.99 Dimensions, David Nelson says that it turns out that not just critical points, but entire phases of matter are described by universal coarse-grained long wavelength theory. One can make similar statements about the hydrodynamic laws derived for fluids in the 19th century. Upon systematically integrating out the high-frequency short-wavelength modes associated with atoms and molecules, one should be able to arrive at, say, the Navier-Stokes equations. The ignorance about the microscopic details is typically packaged into a few phenomenological parameters characterizing the fixed point, such as the density and viscosity of an incompressible fluid. I hope this goes some way to answering the first question about what I mean by universality, but you can shake your head. So I think the key to understand what's going on here is to properly understand what he means by systematically integrating out the short wavelength modes. Bob, let me just ask an ignorant question. Is that ever actually carried out? What he's talking about? Yeah. No, but I think there's a, not, So in this paper, Wilson does give us an idea about how you go about fixing the Landau theory, right, which is a mean field theory, and how you can upscale that to a hydrodynamic theory. That's the way he talks. Not as far as I know completely, but there's a lot of work in homogenization theory which is doing essentially that bit by bit. And it's really sort of interesting, and that's kind of what I wanted to make this connection, because I think the renormalization group is actually an instance of a much more general program of upscaling. And I'll try to make that connection here in a second. So our goal... is to get the numerical values for bulk parameters in terms of the fundamental scale properties. The representative elementary volume method identifies bulk parameters such as density with a limiting average over the REV, and that often fails completely. So here's an example. Consider a composite material consisting of a disconnected and a connected phase in a 50-50 volume mixture. Suppose the red phase is a conductor and the white phase is an insulator. Well, despite having the same volume fraction, the effective bulk behavior of the left system is going to be dramatically more conductive than the right. The REV averaging treats only the volume fraction and misses this mesostructure scale that's relevant to the bulk behavior, namely the topological properties. In that example, it's the connectedness of one region and the boundaries between those phases that carry information about bulk behavior. In other more complicated cases, further microstructural features are important, so surface areas of interfaces, shapes, spatial distributions of phase domains, dislocations, Martin-Senek transformations, etc. And plus, there's also what you might call invaders from higher scales. I mean, take a look at these the corners with the arrows in them. We have no idea at this scale level whether those belong to blobs that are really, really large in comparison with the average size within the square regions. So compare that picture of composites with the picture of a system near criticality. So this is after one of Leo's early papers, where you have a bunch of regions like that, bubbles within bubbles within bubbles. For near critical systems, the REV averaging is just not going to work. Near criticality, the systems is no longer approximately homogeneous. There are two distinct phases that need to be considered. And simple averaging requires figuring out how to weight the different phases. But it's not at all clear that there will be an in principle ab initio way to do that. Following Wilson in that paper that I mentioned, the renormalization group allows you to go from a statistical to a hydrodynamic theory. In the hydrodynamics, there's a density function, which is defined over a continuous variable x, and there's no atomic structure at all. But for the statistical theory, say a set of spins, the order parameter is a function mx, which is the average magnetization in a region surrounding x that contains many lattice sites or atoms. The diameter L of that region is intermediate between the atomic spacing and the correlation length. So m is dependent upon the length L. So there's that picture. That's sort of the picture we get. Since mx is an average, unlike a density in hydrodynamic theory, you can take into account all of the fluctuations in m for lambda less than L, including those at the scale of the atomic spacing A. But because of the L dependence of that function, fluctuations of length of order L or greater are ignored. But those fluctuations are of great importance near criticality, where, as we've seen, we have these bubbles within bubbles within bubbles. And you can see that in observable critical opalescence, the importance of that. So one needs to include the contributions to the order parameter for scales or wavelengths lambda greater than L. And you do that, one does this piecewise, and this is obvious to everybody in this room, probably. Given the average for, Given the average for averaging size L, we have to determine what its value is for averaging L size L plus delta L. So we examine a spatial volume. We divide, this is following Wilson, the average mx in the volume into two parts, a hydrodynamic part with wavelengths essentially up to the size of the system, a fluctuating part with wavelengths between L and this L plus delta L. And by performing this integral, we get an iterative equation for the expression for the free energy for the averaging size L plus delta L in terms of the averaging size L. And we get a step-by-step way to include all the fluctuations, all the physics that plays a role near criticality. One moves from a statistical theory defined over finite n to a hydrodynamic theory of the continuum behavior at criticality. And of course, those infinitesimal steps enable us to derive the RG equation, which tells us how a system gets moved around in a big abstract space of possible systems. And we get out of this the explanation for the macroscopic universality of the distinct systems in terms of the appropriate critical exponent. So, and I think what you have here is a general perspective. It's still counting down, right? Oh, now it's counting up. Okay, we have another related way to think about the relation between models at the nanoscale and those at the level of millimeters. There are different ways to upscale. We've seen that there's the standard averaging method, but there are also homogenization methods where one in effect lets the microscale approach zero. And the renormalization group account of critical behavior, I think, can be seen as an instance of this second kind of approach. So, quickly, as an analogy, consider a corporation that owns many casinos. The CEO of this corporation needs to report to her board the expected profits and losses for her corporation. And her report will undoubtedly refer to a Gaussian distribution showing the probabilities and losses of, with various standard deviations for those statistical predictions. Where does she get the values for the mean and variance for that probability distribution? Should she look to the individual gains within the casino, as the reductionist would have us do? All the details, after all, are in the individual gambles that get played. Or should she look to individual casinos or even to regional groups of casinos? Likely not, right? What she should do is look to the values empirically, determine values that happen at the level of very large groups of casinos where there is a kind of scaling behavior as a matter of fact. So apparent scaling at these large scales is an indication of homogeneity. The values for the mean and for the variance require empirical data. But what is the argument that the parameters themselves, the mean and the variance, are the correct ones? Why values for those parameters? Well, essentially, there's a renormalization group argument showing that central limiting behavior is universal. I've written about this building on work of Jonah Licinio and Sinai and various people. The Gaussian distribution is a fixed point for a wide class of probability distributions under a renormalization group transformation. And so we get this kind of comparison. We've got different situations here with a few parameters characterizing macroscopic behavior, here the Young's modulus, et cetera, because we have this kind of scaling regime up high. And in homogenization methods in general, you consider a system at different scales, a macro scale and a micro scale. If the macro is much smaller than the micro, then we introduce a parameter, a small parameter. And in effect, one looks for a family of functions parameterized by that small parameter epsilon. One that will then provide the effective materials of the property at the macro scale. But that's not, by any means of the imagination, a method for smoothing and averaging. So the homogenization limit, one has various phases of materials or different kinds of materials characterized by different tensor qualities that characterize the behaviors of those phases, quantities. And what we're interested in is finding an effective tensor characterizing the homogeneous bulk property of the system. Can you solve the problem of the tyranny of scales? Well, if one can bridge between the two dominant and apparently incompatible modeling strategies, I think you can. I take it that the renormalization group can be understood as a way of bridging between statistical atomic theories and continuum hydrodynamic theories. It's an instance of a general program of upscaling called homogenization theory, a program that necessarily pays attention to structures that exist at intermediate scales and not simply to structures that exist at the smallest fundamental micro scales. One seeks a means for determining effective moduli characterizing systems as universal in behavior at the macro scale. So in doing so, the recipes, Euler and Cauchy's, have been subject to a systematic and hopefully reasonably rigorous mathematical connection, and it's hard to see how a fully reductionist picture where only the lowest scale atomistic, that is, not microstructural features, are considered, will ever be able to yield the proper empirically determined continuum parameters. Different physics at widely separated length scales contribute to the behavior of materials at the macro level. And I'll just end with a quote from this excellent book by Rob Phillips, Crystals, Defects, and Microstructures. Despite the power of the idea of a material parameter, it must be greeted with caution. For many materials, certain properties are not intrinsic. By that he means not a function of the nature of the atomic constituents. For example, both the yield strength and fracture toughness of a material depend upon its internal constitution. That is, the measured material response can depend upon microstructural features such as grain size, the porosity, etc. Depending upon the extent to which the material has been subject to prior working and annealing, these properties can vary considerably. Even a seemingly elementary property such as the density can depend significantly upon the material's life history. The significance of the types of observations given above is the realization that many material properties depend upon more than just the identity of the particular atomic constituents that make up that material. Microstructural features such as point defects, dislocations, grain boundaries can each alter the measured macroscopic properties of the material. Thank you. And
okay, so we'll start with questions about Bob's talk, and then we'll transition into a more general discussion. It's for the recording, I think.
So I'm still confused about your diagram showing the, quote, universality, unquote, properties of, say, steel. Where's the fixed point? I mean, you've got basically a picture showing, and we noticed it was a logarithmic scale, showing that, for example, steel has densities and Young's moduli varying over more than an order of magnitude. Most people would just say, well, okay, so similar materials have roughly similar properties, although they do vary over quite a large range.
The question is why those particular parameters? Why the Lemay parameters or Young's modulus or whatever? Why are those the relevant parameters?
But how do you know they're the only relevant parameters? I mean, it seems to me that your quote on the last slide pretty much obviates everything you said before, because in fact we know that steel varies enormously in its properties because of things like dislocations and so on
But if what I'm interested in is the bending properties of steel, if I'm interested in building a bridge or a perimeter institute,
then you'd worry about micro cracks.
Well, I worry. Look, if it weren't for the micro cracks, then the steel wouldn't bend, right? So surely, the dislocations and things like that are ways of relieving stress and reducing energies, right? So the physics at these intermediate scales is surely important for why, when we write down the continuum equations, they work so well. That's what I'm trying to understand. Why is it that when I write, why does that Cauchy recipe, which gives me a continuum equation for solids, it's essentially equivalent to the Navier-Stokes equation if you allow plastic deformations, right? Why do those few small parameters, which way Nelson talks, characterize the universality class, or the fixed point, if you want? The question is why. So the analogy is supposed to be like this: in the fluid case of criticality, I've got a macroscopic parameter, the scaling parameter beta that the order parameter scales at to the reduced temperature, right? Why that parameter, right? And why the particular values for that parameter? That's a macroscopic thermodynamic equation, right? And the question, what the renormalization group allows you to do is give you an answer for why you get that sort of scaling behavior, right? And all I'm saying is that I think there's an analogy between that and why the elastic moduli, for example, of certain kinds are the relevant ones for continuum modeling, right? So how can we understand the success and the safety of continuum modeling given the fact that it almost completely ignores the micro details? Well, the key is to say exactly in what way it almost ignores them, right? Or how it considers them.
So you didn't say anything about symmetry, the role of symmetry in establishing the sort of inevitable functional form of, say, Landau theory or Navier-Stokes equations or whatever. And most people would say that's really where you end up deriving the structure of the equations, and then you have to find a lower level description to calculate the coefficients that go in there. Could you say something about that and how that comes up in your discussion?
Well, I think there's some symmetry that's just a fact. The way that if what we're interested in is understanding scaling relations near for thermodynamic systems, right? We have all the Widom rules, etc., and that's an empirically observed feature that systems at macro scales exhibit kind of scaling relations, right? That's a fundamental input into the argument. So there's a symmetry there in that sense, right? There's self-similarity in that, and that's what leads. That's in fact what led in the historical controversy. It was noticing that led people like Green and Stokes to try to employ pure downward methods, right? Starting pure continuum methods to derive the continuum equations. There are all sorts of symmetry breakings that take place in the attempts to upscale the behavior of steel from its atomic pure lattice structure, right? Using dislocations and various things. So I might have missed your question, I guess. What did I missed your question.
Well, we can talk later if there's an extended discussion.
Okay, sorry.
So I was confused by your references to reductionism, because on the slide before the last slide said something like a reduction, and maybe I'm misquoting or misunderstanding, you said something like a reductionist account will not work because there is a dependence on the history of the system.
Well, it's not only on the history of the system, but of structures that exist at scales, what you might call, so micro scale is not a synonym for atomic scale. Right, in the way I've been talking, maybe that's what's sort of confusing.
No, I guess I'm curious at what it seemed to me your entire discussion was within what I would call reductionist. Reductionist means, well, maybe you should. What you're the philosopher. What is the definition of reductionism you're using?
So, if the Butterfield program for just telling the story about why we're justified in using continuum models works, that is to say, it's merely a matter of convenience, right? In principle, were we to just start with our fundamental, Schrodinger equation for all of the atoms in the lattice that make up the steel, we would be able to figure out what the macroscopic behaviors of the steel girder are, then I would say that's what the ultimate reductionist program is. Continuum models are just there merely for pragmatic reasons, right? And I'm trying to argue that if you go all the way down to that level, you miss out on all sorts of structures that, in a certain sense, emerge and are critically important for the actual behavior of the material at the continuum level. And that's exactly what I take that quote to be saying.
Okay, but so I'm not a reductionist in that sense, but I can play one pretty well. It seems to me that we're allowed in applying the Schrodinger equation for many body system to set initial conditions that reflect information knowledge we have of the history of the system. And therefore, must it not be the case that there are some initial conditions for the material that take into account the intermediate scales structures and would account for the macroscopic properties completely.
So as I understand what's going on in this homogenization approach, which is which that book by Phillips I recommend highly for anybody interested in materials. There are contrary to the sort of bottom-up approach that reductionism seems to entail, right? There are various feedback loops, right? So at some level, all of a sudden, we have to start taking into consideration dislocations in the lattice, right? And we then need to figure out how to model the dislocations. And then actually, sometimes what they do is they provide continuum models of dislocations. And the different modeling strategies at this different scales across this tyranny of scales are inform pass information from one scale to another in both directions. It's not simply that I can, I mean, what you just said, in effect, I think says that you agree with me in that, yeah, something about the history or the larger scale geometric properties, if I can incorporate that into the Schrodinger equation, then I can write down something which looks like a good function, but a good theory. But that's to incorporate information that comes from higher scales, which is not what the reductionist program is all about.
Okay, we'll come back to this.
Yeah, okay. I have a cue here, but I would like to encourage people that we can
talk
shift
to Leo.
Into a more general discussion.
Good.
Leo's on the hook.
I just have a short comment and then a short question. There was a question earlier about the role of symmetry or invariance principles. I just want to remind people, I think most people in the audience know, that, for example, the hydrodynamic limit, the reason why it's stable is because those variables that you choose obey conservation laws. And in the decoherent history viewpoint, in Gell-Mann, you know, Hartle, Griffith, and so on, they emphasize that those are the criteria, that's why those variables, because they are stable, that you can use to because they are conservation, they obey conservation laws, that the description has a certain quasi stability to it. So the symmetry laws certainly play a role. That's just a comment. And then the question is, you mentioned homogenization theory several times, but probably you didn't have time to go into it. What's the main gist there? I mean, what are the things that physicists can take from philosophers?
This is from applied mathematics, is not from...
As interpreted by philosophers.
Well, as interpreted by philosophers, I suppose. There is a huge literature out there which I find involves sort of upscaling techniques, how to connect models, how to determine effective parameters for systems that are heterogeneous at the microscale. It all started with how to deal with partial differential equations where you've got a fast variable and a slow variable, or in space where you've got heterogeneities at some small scale, and what you're interested in is coming up with parameters that characterize a system as at the macro level where it appears to be homogeneous, right? So that's there's a literature that's, and there are connections between I mean, I go into this in a longer paper, but there are connections between the difference between first and second order perturbation theory, and the central limiting kind of behavior being more akin to renormalization and homogenization theory, as opposed to stopping at first order where what you get are just law of large number and averaging behaviors. And so. I mean, in a certain sense, I don't think there's anything new in it. I think that what at least I found to be interesting was that there is a literature out there that I'm not sure physicists know very much about, in which it turns out that if you think about it, that's why I tried to use those make an analogy between those two phase pictures and Leo's picture of the of the spin systems near criticality, right? That what's really important there is that near criticality, fluids are heterogeneous, right? But what we're really trying to do is figure out what they look like in the limit at the macro level, right? And so we're looking for effective parameters that characterize that behavior, namely scaling exponents for the order parameters, right? And so there's an analogy there I thought was really quite interesting. Maybe it's just obvious to everybody. It's entirely possible that it is, or maybe it's just wrong. But I honestly thought, well, okay, so near criticality, one of the reason mean field theory fails is because near criticality, the thing exhibits multiple phases that are important, and we have to figure out how to deal with those different phases, or equivalently with the fluctuations at all orders. And
a superfluid provides an interesting example which has in it the same conservation laws but different macroscopic properties. Somehow the microscopics and the macroscopics come together in a rich way and an unexpected way in superconductors, and neither a simple point of view where we can determine everything by thinking about symmetries and continua, nor a point of view in which we have to get every detail of the microscopics. Neither seem entirely correct.
Right.
We have to take a point of view which includes both macroscopic and macroscopic in order to fully understand, I believe.
That was basically the point.
So I had a general question, not just for Bob, but for the audience. I'm confused about the whole argument about reductionism. Is it the claim that given the microscopic equations, we would never have guessed what all are possible till they actually happen? Or is the debate, given that we know they happen, could we get there from the microscopic principles? I mean, what is the debate about? Does anybody really doubt that given that we know something like superconductivity occurs, we can go back and deduce it? Or do they say, you would never have guessed it? I mean, the equation was there all these years.
So the way I look at it is the former. So it was an empirical discovery that various fluids of different kinds exhibit the same scaling behavior near criticality, despite the fact that they have different critical temperatures and pressures, et cetera. I mean, that famous graph of Guggenheim where all the data collapses onto the reduced, onto a graph which is of, in terms of reduced temperature and reduced density. So there's the universality claim. Now, on a reductionist strategy, what would you do? Well, at best you'd be able to do is say, okay, I need to go back to the original most fundamental equation. Suppose it's a Schrodinger equation. The Schrodinger equation for what? Well, say for the fluid argon, right? So I write that down, and maybe I can derive somehow by using lots of computers and some approximations an account that tells me why argon scales the way it does near criticality. But that doesn't tell me anything about the other systems, right? That's the beauty of the renormalization group explanation. So it seems to me that a reductionist account in the sense that, in principle, could we describe the behavior of one system from the fundamental equations? Could we predict it? Maybe. Could we answer the question that requires observation, that surprised people about why there is this universal behavior, by going to the fundamental equation by itself and not employing all these continuum limits and all the renormalization group apparatus? I think the answer is no. Right. And so there's one reason, I think, to be wary of a reductionist claim, right? Namely, it seems difficult to understand how a reductionist claim, which goes and talks about the actual physics of particular systems, right, is ever going to be able to answer questions about universality, universal behavior.
I was just thinking that it was important to recognize that it wasn't just Ansager, that experiments played a very important role in determining what people thought about the system. People would have believed mean field theory for a much longer period of time had there not been experiments showing a likely infinity in the specific heat of various fluids, an infinity that was not built into the mean field theory model. So I would urge upon the people upon to view what we see around us as a partial determinant of what we believe, and experiment is a necessary piece of all of this going on.
Yeah, I remain quite confused about your use of reductionism and what was said, well, in response okay. to Lee and so on. I mean, you said something about deriving, properties of steel from the Schrodinger equation. Well, you can't derive anything from the Schrodinger equation. You have to know the state, right? So if I give you the Schrodinger equation and the initial state, you should be able to derive everything, at least if the Schrodinger equation is applicable, and so on. Now, what you seem to mean is, by reductionism, is that if I give you the Schrodinger equation and make some assumption about the state that there are no interesting correlations going on at scales much above the microscopic, then I can't derive all the properties of steel or something, which I agree, because that if you have defects and so on that are not, but what in the world does that have to do with reductionism? I mean, there's a separate question of would it be useful to try to, approach the proper derivation of properties of steel from this, Schrodinger equation and trying to give you the state. And of course,
maybe
go more extreme from the standard model and QCD and so on. I mean, I think that's probably not a good way of approaching, but I can't say what's wrong with the reductionist type statement that if I gave you the exact microscopic equations and gave you the exact state, you could in principle make the predictions.
Okay, so
at least what you've said. I mean, chaos and so on may be a reason,
right?
That also won't work if there are finite errors.
Right. So I have no ultimate argument against that sort of in principle reductionism. The question. One of the things that I'm kind of worried about is this debate about the role of how to understand infinities in the renormalization group. And various philosophers, anyway, who are deeply confused, I believe, have been arguing that it is a paradigm example of a reductionist strategy. Okay? And I can quote you if you want. So what I'm trying to say is, sorry, if our goal as philosophers of science or whatever is to sort of take a look at the actual methodology employed by scientists working in these areas, then it doesn't look like they're doing anything like this in principle case where, yes, it's entirely possible, I suppose, in principle, although I'd like to say that this is all anybody ever says, it's in principle possible, but they never articulate it beyond that. They say exactly what you said. Give me the Schrodinger equation and the exact initial state for the system, and I'll derive all the behaviors of interest that you want for that system. If that's fine, maybe you can do that, I don't know, but I'd like to see some evidence about why that's the case. And furthermore, I think as Leo just said, an awful lot of this information that we have here is coming from experiment, right? The values for the, it's not clear that we're going to be able to derive the values for the moduli for these solids.
But part of what I'm confused, are you suggesting that we can't?
Well,
let me borrow an idea from the computer scientist. I would like to consider two views of a reductionist strategy. One is, what could we derive if we had a set of theorists capable of solving all equations for all finite systems and holding the results in their memory at once? The second question, which is a different question, is, what would we get if we had a set of theorists who were capable of solving equations for infinite systems and holding the result in their memory? In the first case, we would have no direct understanding of superconductivity, whereas in the second, we would. And so your assumptions determine the nature of your reductionism, in my opinion. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it might be helpful to try to sharpen the disagreement between you and Butterfield, because I think perhaps you disagree.
I don't think most people here care about the disagreement between me and Butterfield.
Well, it's going to try to maybe sharpen your position a little bit, because I think you actually don't disagree on very much at all. I mean, Butterfield wouldn't disagree that the REV methods don't apply in the kind of cases you're talking about. Okay, so pragmatic. Now, these RG methods and the other upscaling methods are also pragmatic. You use them for pragmatic reasons. There's no other practical way to derive the results. Right? They're practical in that sense. They're pragmatic.
Given what Leo just said, there's no other way to derive them if you just stick with the finite theory.
Right, but they're still used for pragmatic reasons.
In the sense that if I'm interested in trying to understand what the world is like, if that's a pragmatic reason, okay.
And you've got the same kind of claims about mathematical convenience here that he has about the REV methods and empirical adequacy.
No, I'm claiming that without these methods, you wouldn't get answers to the questions that we're interested in.
So the only point of disagreement, I think that's the only issue in dispute. That's the point of my question. So the issue in dispute is Butterfield thinks there's an alternate route, perhaps a route from the base level, the atomic level, and you say there isn't an alternate route. I think that is the only point of disagreement with respect to the other issues.
That's one point, but I hope it's not the only point that you take away from my talk, because I thought, in effect, that I was trying to show that there is a much more general question about how you connect modeling practices that are required to understand the behavior of systems that exist across large ranges of scales, right? And that's independent of any debate about between Butterfield and me about the use of continuum limits, right? I mean, it's an interesting issue. It's much more general, and the point was that I thought one can profitably see the renormalization group as an instance of this more general program called homogenization theory by the applied mathematicians. But secondly, it's got really interesting historical roots in this debate between Navier and Cauchy and Green and Stokes, which unfortunately I didn't get to talk about. But.
Fair enough. The question is really, the point is really that it's equally pragmatic, these upscaling techniques and REV, and you and Butterfield would agree that there's
think
no...
I just disagree with that claim.
There's no reduction in these cases to the atomic level. So we'd certainly hold on that.
Well, one way of understanding what Butterfield says, if continuum modeling is something that is merely there for convenience, then that is certain, in a certain sense says we can get rid of it. It's eliminable, reducible. We can do everything by talking about the finite, by the finite things. And I'm just claiming that that's false.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. There's no reduction to the atomic level.
Whatever we mean by reductionism, we cannot take the initial state or say the ground state of a system as an input of the problem. That's part of the problem. The hard problem in quantum many-body theory is given the Hamiltonian finding the ground state, and that's very hard. So of course, if I'm given the ground state, then I can compute everything very easily, at least at zero temperature. But so the question is, can I find the ground state or the expectation values of all the relevant observables starting from the Hamiltonian? So that's the question. You cannot give the state as an input, because then you are done, basically.
Right.
I mean, if you're interested in the defects in steel and all, you're not interested in the ground state of steel. You're interested in some wide class of states that all have different properties. I mean, and that I think you do have to give as an input. Now, of course, it may be better to derive that, I mean, from, you know, some other assumptions that describe the history of the steel and so on. But I was sort of objecting to the idea that, it seemed to me that what you have in mind with reductionism is reductionism with some additional oversimplifying assumptions or whatever.
I completely agree
that give you the
but
right
that's
answer,
the I, but that, those are people that I'm arguing against are people I'm arguing against believe this overly simplified view. Give me the Schrodinger equation and the initial state exactly, yeah, and I'll derive
that's
everything.
That's not what I'm calling the simplified. I'm the simplified view saying give the Schrodinger equation and make some oversimplified assumption about the initial state, and then you can derive everything, and that's wrong. But I was asking before, I mean, do you have some, I'm not saying this is a good, I'm not advocating this as a good way to approach the problem. It's obviously a terrible way to approach the problem, but I don't have any reason to believe that it's wrong. You seem to be suggesting either that it's wrong or that it very well might be wrong, and that I'm a little bit perplexed by.
Well, maybe we can talk later about it.
So I've got two other questions I want to ask you. So you keep emphasizing about homogenization, and you talk about the normalization group in the connection of the critical point phenomena. So I wanted to make the point that actually the renormalization group is much more general than the critical point phenomena. And so I view homogenization as actually a special case of the renormalization group. And you can derive results from homogenization theory directly from just the renormalization group program itself. So I think that sort of perspective, that algorithm, that process is perhaps the most general way of making the connection between the scales. So that was my first point. The second point I want to ask, I guess Lee Smolin asked a question about the Navier-Stokes equation, so and it relates to this discussion we're having about the different levels of description. So the question is, why use the sort of more continuum approach compared to the sort of reductionist approach? So there is a reductionist there's a reductionist derivation of the Navier-Stokes equation. So Boltzmann already did that 100 years ago. You can write down the dynamics of particles bouncing around in a box, and then through various calculations that he worked out using kinetic theory, you can derive perfectly well the Navier-Stokes equations, and everything is fine. You think you've got a good theory of fluids. The reason why you don't do it that way, or why that's not considered satisfactory, is that the regime of validity of that resulting equation is limited to the regime of validity of the approximations that you had to make on the scattering theory in order to derive it. So you know that that works in some regime, but the Navier-Stokes equations have a much broader range of validity in, say, terms of particle density, and you understand that where that really comes from are the symmetry the principles, and the reductionist calculation simply by doing things correctly, by not violating laws of physics and laws of mathematics, inevitably ends up reflecting those broader symmetry principles. So that's how I see the relation between these things. It's related to Leo's point about taking the thermodynamic limits and being able to see superconductivity and so on. So that was the comment I wanted to make. Do you have any? I don't know whether those comments are actually disagree or agree with the points you're saying.
I think the second one agrees with what I'm trying to say. The first one about which is more fundamental, the renormalization group or homogenization, is a question that I don't really know how to answer. I mean, as somebody who spent a long time trying to understand renormalization and sort of conceptually what's going on, I was surprised to discover in the context of all this materials science stuff and various other areas that there is an entire other field which seems to have been developed independently, and only very few times are there any connections made between the two. Some sophisticated authors do make connections, like Phillips, between renormalization and homogenization sort of results, but very few do. And it struck me as that simple two-phase diagram struck me as a very interesting way of thinking about, from the homogenization point of view, that what we have here is a heterogeneous system near criticality, and what we're looking for is how to homogenize it. I think that is an interesting analogy and an interesting way of understanding, you know, on the surface, why mean field theory failed in rather stark pictorial form. That's sort of the connection. Whether the renormalization group methods are more powerful and the homogenization theory ones are derivable from them is something I don't know the answer to.
I'm sorry, I realize that there are several people in the queue, so I think we'll only have time for one last question before switching to coffee. So,
is this even on? Right. I don't know whether this is a comment or a thought experiment or just a handy example to have in the back of one's mind when thinking about these questions. I mean, one thing that's listening to everybody here, I'm still not entirely clear about what people mean by microscopic and macroscopic. And in order to clarify this, here's an example. There's some systems, largely thought experiments, I think, that were played with in quantum chaos several years ago. I think they're called quantum carpets, but you can get these not just in particle-in-a-box scenario, but also when you have the box is like an oval or some other shape. Now, what happens with these is your wave function goes bouncing around. And if your system is classically chaotic, or, you know, classical billiard ball in that system would be chaotic, what you get is these strange structures forming as a result of the path integral effect, which are sometimes called scars. Right now, if you want to construct a microscopic model of what's going on in there, you have to take into account the entire shape of the box. Right? So when you say microscopic model, do you strictly limit that to short ranges? Right? I think this is a point that needs to be clarified. Or, because I mean, if you're saying, oh, well, I do my microscopic theory, but I'm taking into account the entire box, right? I think somebody could reasonably argue that you are sneaking in macroscopic stuff by the back door when you do that.
Well, you're sneaking in boundary effects, which is one of the things which are representative elementary volume averaging is supposed to get rid of. So the whole point of why that justification doesn't work is that these boundary effects and geometrical features like that, especially in the Bunimovich stadium and things like that, where you're right, there's this scarring stuff comes in there.
I just wanted people to be precise because, I mean, if you allow too large a category of things to count as microscopic, right there's a risk that you get a statement which is true but trivial and completely uninformative. Or if you have something which is more strictly defined to say ban taking into account the long-range boundary conditions, then the statement's false.
Right. So in some of the, at least in that Phillips book, he's quite careful, and I was trying to be, but probably wasn't. sufficiently careful to distinguish sort of between atomic and lowest level scales and continuum level scales and micro scales, which are things in between, or mesos. I mean, I would think maybe mesoscopic scales would be better. But I agree that one needs to consider, in many instances, these effects of boundaries in particular, which are in some sense macroscopic. It's called microstructures, defects, crystals, microstructures, and defects, modeling across scales, 2002.